I work for money launderers, remember, Wayne? So I've become an expert on hiding money in offshore accounts. We'll see. When do I see this notebook on the Meraltos? After we get your files and pay our first installment. We'll brief you as much as we can, but for the most part, you're on your own. You and I will need to meet a lot, and of course, that'll be rather dangerous. May have to take a few bus rides. Okay. But the next time I get the aisle seat. Sure, sure. Anybody worth $2 million can surely pick his seat on a Greyhound. I'll never live to enjoy it, Wayne. You know I won't. 3 miles out of Georgetown, on the narrow and winding road to Bodentown, Mitch saw him. The man was squatting behind an old Volkswagen Beetle with the hood up as if engine trouble had stopped him. The man was dressed like a native, without tourist clothes. He could easily pass for one of the Brits who worked for the government or the banks. He was well tanned. The man held a wrench of some sort and appeared to study it and watch the Mitsubishi Jeep as it roared by on the left-hand side of the road. The man was the Nordic. He was supposed to have gone unnoticed. Mitch instinctively slowed to 30 miles per hour to wait for him. Abby turned and watched the road. The narrow highway to Bodentown clung to the shoreline for 5 miles, then forked, and the ocean disappeared. Within minutes, the Nordic's green VW came racing around a slight bend. The McDear Jeep was much closer than the Nordic anticipated. Being seen, he abruptly slowed, then turned into the first white rock driveway on the ocean side. Mitch gunned the Jeep and sped to Bodentown. West of the small settlement, he turned south and less than a mile later found the ocean. It was 10 a.m., and the parking lot of A-Bank's dive lodge was half full. The 2 morning dive boats had left 30 minutes earlier. The McDears walked quickly to the bar, where Henry was already shuffling beer and cigarettes to the domino players. Barry Abanks leaned on a post supporting the thatched roof of the bar and watched as his 2 dive boats disappeared around the corner of the island. Each would make 2 dives at places like Bonnie's Arch, Devil's Grotto, Eden Rock, and Roger's Wreck Point, places he had dived and toured and guided through 1,000 times. Some of the places he had discovered himself. The McDears approach, and Mitch quietly introduced his wife to Mr. Abanks, who was not polite but not rude. They started for the small pier where a deckhand was preparing a 30-foot fishing boat. Abanks unloaded an indecipherable string of commands in the general direction of the young deckhand, who was either deaf or unafraid of his boss. Mitch stood next to Abanks, the captain now, and pointed to the bar 50 yards away down the pier. "Do you know all those people at the bar?" he asked. Abanks frowned at Mitch. "They tried to follow me here." "Just curious," Mitch said. "The usual gang," Abanks said. "No strangers." "Have you noticed any strangers around this morning?" "Look, this place attracts strange people. I keep no ledger of the strange ones and the normal ones. Have you seen a fat American, red hair, at least 300 pounds? Abanks shook his head. The deckhand eased the boat backward, away from the pier, then toward the horizon. Abby sat on a small padded bench and watched the dive lodge disappear. In a vinyl bag between her feet were 2 new sets of snorkeling fins and dive masks. It was ostensibly a snorkeling trip with maybe a little light fishing, if they were biting. The great man himself had agreed to accompany them, but only after Mitch insisted and told him they needed to discuss personal matters. Private matters regarding the death of his son. From a screened balcony on the 2nd floor of a Cayman Cay beach house, The Nordic watched the two snorkeled heads bob and disappear around the fishing boat. He handed the binoculars to two-ton Tony Verkler, who, quickly bored, handed them back. A striking blonde in a black one-piece with legs cut high, almost to the ribcage, stood behind the Nordic and took the binoculars. Of particular interest was the deckhand. Tony spoke.
"I don't understand. If they were talking serious, why the boy? Why have another set of ears around?"
"Perhaps they're talking about snorkeling and fishing," said the Nordic.
"I don't know," said the blonde. "It's unusual for A-Banks to spend time on a fishing boat. He likes the divers. There must be a good reason for him to waste a day with two novice snorkelers. Something's up."
"Who's the boy?" asked Tony.
"Just one of the gophers," she said. "He's got a dozen."
"Can you talk to him later?" asked the Nordic.
"Yeah," said Tony. "Show him some skin, snort some candy. He'll talk."
"I'll try," she said.
"What's his name?" asked the Nordic.
"Keith Rook."
Keith Rook maneuvered the boat alongside the pier at Rum Point. Mitch, Abby, and A-Banks climbed from the boat and headed for the beach. Keith was not invited to lunch. He stayed behind and lazily washed the deck. The shipwreck bar sat inland 100 yards under a heavy cover of rare shade trees. It was dark and damp, with screened windows and squeaky ceiling fans. There was no reggae, dominoes, or dartboard. The noon crowd was quiet, with each table engrossed in its own private talk. The view from their table was out to sea, to the north. They ordered cheeseburgers and beer. Island food.
"This bar is different," Mitch observed quietly.
"Very much so," said A-Banks. "And with good reason. It's a hangout for drug dealers who own many of the nice homes and condos around here. They fly in on their private jets, deposit their money in our many fine banks, and spend a few days around here checking their real estate."
"Nice neighborhood."
"Very nice, really. They have millions, and they keep to themselves."
The waitress, a husky, well-mixed mulatto, dropped 3 bottles of Jamaican Red Stripe on the table without saying a word. A-Banks leaned forward on his elbows with his head lowered, the customary manner of speaking in the shipwreck bar.
"So you think you can walk away?" he said.
Mitch and Abby leaned forward in unison, and all 3 heads met low in the center of the table, just over the beer.
"Not walk, but run. Run like hell, but I'll get away. And I'll need your help."
He thought about this for a moment and raised his head. He shrugged.
"But what am I to do?"
He took the first sip of his Red Stripe. Abby saw her first, and it would take a woman to spot another woman straining ever so elegantly to eavesdrop on their little conversation. Her back was to A-Banks. She was a solid blonde, partially hidden under cheap black rubber sunglasses that covered most of her face, and she had been watching the ocean and listening a bit too hard. When the 3 of them leaned over, she sat up straight and listened like hell. She was by herself at a table for 2. Abby dug her fingernails into her husband's leg, and their table became quiet. The blonde in black listened, then turned to her table and her drink. Wayne Terrence had improved his wardrobe by Friday of Cayman Week. Gone were the straw sandals and tight shorts and teeny-bop sunglasses. Gone were the sickly pale legs. Now they were bright pink, burned beyond recognition. After 3 days in the tropical outback known as Cayman Brac, he and Acklin, acting on behalf of the U.S. government, had pounced on a rather cheap room on Grand Cayman,
miles from Seven Mile Beach and not within walking distance of any remote portion of the sea. Here they had established a command post to monitor the comings and goings of the McDears and other interested people. Here, at the Coconut Motel, they had shared a small room with two single beds and cold showers. Wednesday morning, they had contacted the subject, McDear, and requested a meeting as soon as possible. He said no, said he was too busy, said he and his wife were honeymooning and had no time for such a meeting. Maybe later, was all he said. Then late Thursday, while Mitch and Abby were enjoying grilled grouper at the lighthouse on the road to Bodentown, Laney, Agent Laney, dressed in appropriate island garb and looking very much like an island Negro, stopped at their table and laid down the law. Terence insisted on a meeting. Chickens had to be imported into the Cayman Islands, and not the best ones. Only medium-grade chickens, to be consumed not by native islanders, but by Americans away from home without this most basic staple. Colonel Sanders had the damnedest time teaching the island girls, though black or close to it, how to fry chicken. It was foreign to them. And so it was that Special Agent Wayne Terrence of the Bronx arranged a quick secret meeting at the Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise on the island of Grand Cayman, the only such franchise. He thought the place would be deserted. He was wrong. 100 hungry tourists from Georgia, Alabama, Texas, and Mississippi packed the place and devoured extra crispy with coleslaw and creamed potatoes. It tasted better in Tupelo, but it would do. Terence and Acklin sat in a booth in the crowded restaurant and nervously watched the front door. It was not too late to abort. There were just too many people. Finally, Mitch entered by himself and stood in the long line. He brought his little red box to their table and sat down. He did not say hello or anything. He began eating the three-piece dinner for which he paid $4.89, Cayman dollars. Imported chicken. "Where have you been?" Terence asked. Mitch attacked a thigh. "On the island? It's stupid to meet here, Terence. Too many people. We know what we're doing. Yeah, like the Korean shoe store. Cute. Why wouldn't you see us Wednesday?" "I was busy Wednesday. I didn't want to see you Wednesday. Am I clean?" "Of course you're clean. Laney would have tackled you at the front door if you weren't clean." "This place makes me nervous, Terence. Why did you go to A-Banks?" Mitch wiped his mouth and held the partially devoured thigh. A rather small thigh. "He's got a boat. I wanted to fish and snorkel, so we cut a deal." "Where were you, Terence? In a submarine trailing us around the island?" "What did A-Banks say?" "Oh, he knows lots of words. Hello? Give me a beer? Who's following us? Bunch of words." "They followed you, you know." "They? Which they? Your they or their they? I'm being followed so much I'm causing traffic jams." "The bad guys, Mitch. Those from Memphis and Chicago and New York. The ones who will kill you tomorrow if you get real cute." "I'm touched. So they followed me. Where'd I take them? Snorkeling? Fishing? Come on, Terence. They follow me. You follow them. You follow me. They follow you. If I slam on brakes, I get 20 noses up my ass. Why are we meeting here, Terence? This place is packed." Terence glanced around in frustration. Mitch closed his chicken box. "Look, Terence, I'm nervous, and I've lost my appetite." "Relax. You were clean coming from the condo."
I'm always clean, Terence. I suppose Hodge and Kaczynski were clean every time they moved. Clean at Abanks, clean on the dive boat, clean at the funerals. This was not a good idea, Terence. I'm leaving. Okay. When does your plane leave?
Why?
You guys plan to follow?
Will you follow me or them?
What if they follow you? What if we all get real confused and I follow everybody?
Come on, Mitch.
9:40 in the morning. I'll try to save you a seat. You can have the window next to Two-Ton Tony. When do we get your files?
Mitch stood with his chicken box.
In a week or so. Give me 10 days. And Terence, no more meetings in public. They kill lawyers, remember, not stupid FBI agents.
Chapter 26. At 8 Monday morning, Oliver Lambert and Nathan Locke were cleared through the concrete wall on the fifth floor and walked through the maze of small rooms and offices. Devasher was waiting. He closed the door behind them and pointed to the chairs. His walk was not as quick. The night had been a long, losing battle with the vodka. The eyes were red and the brain expanded with each breath.
I talked with Lazarov yesterday in Las Vegas. I explained as best I could why you boys were so reluctant to fire your four lawyers, Lynch, Sorrell, Bunton, and Myers. I gave them all your good reasons. He said he'd think about it, but in the meantime, make damn sure those four work on nothing but clean files. Take no chances, and watch them closely.
He's really a nice guy, isn't he? Oliver Lambert said.
Oh, yes. A real charmer.
He said Mr. Meralto has asked about the firm once a week for 6 weeks now. Said they're all anxious.
What did you tell him?
Told him things are secure, for now. Leaks are plugged, for now. I don't think he believes me.
What about McDear? Asked Locke.
He had a wonderful week with his wife. Have you ever seen her in a string bikini? She wore one all week. Outstanding. We got some pictures, just for fun.
I didn't come here to look at pictures, Locke snapped.
You don't say. They spent an entire day with our little pal Abanks, just the three of them and a deckhand. They played in the water, did some fishing, and they did a lot of talking. About what, we don't know. Never could get close enough. But it makes me very suspicious, guys. Very suspicious.
I don't see why, said Oliver Lambert.
What can they talk about besides fishing and diving, and of course, Hodge and Kaczynski? And so they talk about Hodge and Kaczynski. What's the harm?
He never knew Hodge and Kaczynski, Oliver, said Locke. Why would he be so interested in their deaths?
Keep in mind, said Devasher, the Terence told him at their first meeting that the deaths were not accidental. So now he's Sherlock Holmes looking for clues.
He won't find any, will he, Devasher?
Hell no. It was a perfect job. Oh, sure, there are a few unanswered questions, but the Caymanian police damn sure can't answer them. Neither can our boy McDear.
Then why are you worried? Asked Lambert.
Because they're worried in Chicago, Ollie, and they pay me real good money to stay worried down here. And until the Fibbies leave us alone, everybody stays worried, okay?
What else did he do?
The usual Cayman vacation. Sex, sun, rum, a little shopping and sightseeing. We had three people on the island, and they lost them a couple of times, but nothing serious, I hope. Like I've always said, you can't trail a man 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, without getting caught. So we have to play it cool sometimes.
You think McDear's talking? Asked Locke.
I know he lies, Nat. He lied about the incident in the Korean shoe store a month ago. You guys didn't want to believe it, but I'm convinced he went into that store voluntarily because he wanted to talk with Terence.
One of our guys made a mistake, got too close, so the little meeting broke up. That ain't McDear's version, but that's what happened. Yeah, Nat, I think he's talking. Maybe he meets with Terrence and tells him to go to hell. Maybe they're smoking dope together. I don't know.
But you have nothing concrete, Devasher, Ollie said. The brain expanded and pressed mightily against the skull. It hurt too much to get mad.
No, Ollie, nothing like Hodge and Kaczynski, if that's what you mean. We had those boys on tape and knew they were about to talk. McDear's a little different.
He's also a rookie, said Nat. An 8-month lawyer who knows nothing. He's spent 1,000 hours on sweat files, and the only clients he's handled have been legitimate. Avery's been extremely careful about the files McDear's touched. We've talked about it.
He has nothing to say because he knows nothing, added Ollie.
Marty and Joe knew a hell of a lot, but they'd been here for years. McDear's a new recruit.
Devasher gently massaged his temples.
So you've hired a real dumbass. Let's just suppose the FBI has a hunch who our biggest client is. Okay? Think along with me. And let's just suppose Hodge and Kaczynski fed them enough to confirm the identity of this particular client. See where I'm going? And let's suppose the Fibbies have told McDear all they know, along with a certain amount of embellishment. Suddenly, your ignorant rookie recruit is a very smart man, and a very dangerous one.
How do you prove this?
We step up surveillance, for starters. Put his wife under 24-hour watch. I've already called Lazarov and requested more men. Told him we needed some fresh faces. I'm going to Chicago tomorrow to brief Lazarov and maybe Mr. Maralto. Lazarov thinks Maralto has a lead on a mole within the bureau, some guy who's close to Voiles and will sell information. But it's expensive, supposedly. They want to assess things and decide where to go.
And you'll tell them McDear's talking? Asked Locke.
I'll tell them what I know and what I suspect. I'm afraid that if we sit back and wait for concrete, it might be too late. I'm sure Lazarov will want to discuss plans to eliminate him.
Preliminary plans, Ollie asked, with a touch of hope.
We've passed the preliminary stage, Ollie.
The Hourglass Tavern in New York City faces 46th Street, near its corner with 9th Avenue. A small, dark hole in the wall with 22 seats, it grew to fame with its expensive menu and 59-minute time limit on each meal. On the walls not far above the tables, hourglasses with white sand silently collect the seconds and minutes until the tavern's timekeeper, the waitress, finally makes her calculations and calls time. Frequented by the Broadway crowd, it is usually packed with loyal fans waiting on the sidewalk. Lou Lazarov liked the hourglass because it was dark and private conversations were possible. Short conversations, under 59 minutes. He liked it because it was not in Little Italy, and he was not Italian, and although he was owned by Sicilians, he did not have to eat their food. He liked it because he was born and spent the first 40 years of his life in the theater district. Then corporate headquarters was moved to Chicago, and he was transferred. But business required his presence in New York at least twice a week, and when the business included meeting a member of equal stature from another family, Lazarov always suggested the hourglass. Tubertini had equal stature and a little extra. Reluctantly, he agreed on the hourglass. Lazarov arrived first and did not wait for a table. He knew from experience the crowd thinned around 4 p.m., especially on Thursdays. He ordered a glass of red wine. The waitress tipped the hourglass above his head, and the race was on. He sat at a front table facing the street, his back to the other tables.
He was a heavy man of 58 with a thick chest and ponderous belly. He leaned hard on the red checkered tablecloth and watched the traffic on 46th. Thankfully, Tubertini was prompt. Less than a fourth of the white sand was wasted on him. They shook hands politely while Tubertini scornfully surveyed the tiny sliver of a restaurant. He flashed a plastic smile at Lazarov and glared at his seat in the window. His back would face the street, and this was extremely irritating and dangerous. But his car was just outside with two of his men. He decided to be polite. He deftly maneuvered around the tiny table and sat down. Tubertini was polished. He was 37, the son-in-law of old man Palumbo himself. Family. Married his only daughter. He was beautifully thin and tanned with his short black hair oiled to perfection and slicked back. He ordered red wine. "How's my pal Joey Maralto?" he asked, with a perfect, brilliant smile. "Fine. And Mr. Palumbo?" "Very ill and very ill-tempered, as usual. Please give him my regards." "Certainly." The waitress approached and looked menacingly at the timepiece. "Just wine," said Tubertini. "I won't be eaten." Lazarov looked at the menu and handed it to her. "Sautéed blackfish, with another glass of wine." Tubertini glanced at his men in the car. They appeared to be napping. "So what's wrong in Chicago?" "Nothing's wrong. We just need a little information, that's all. We've heard, unconfirmed of course, that you have a very reliable man somewhere deep in the bureau, somewhere close to Voyles." "And if we do?" "We need some information from this man. We have a small unit in Memphis, and the Fibbies are trying like hell to infiltrate. We suspect one of our employees may be working with them, but we can't seem to catch him." "And if you caught him?" "We'd slice out his liver and feed it to the rats." "Serious, huh?" "Extremely serious. Something tells me the feds have targeted our little unit down there, and we've grown quite nervous." "Let's say his name is Alfred, and let's say he's very close to the Voyles." "Okay. We need a very simple answer from Alfred. We need to know, yes or no, if our employee is working with the Fibbies." Tubertini watched Lazarov and sipped his wine. "Alfred specializes in simple answers. He prefers the yes and no variety. We've used him twice, only when it's critical, and both times it was a question of, are the feds coming here or there? He's extremely cautious. I don't think he would provide too many details." "Is he accurate?" "Deadly accurate." "Then he should be able to help us. If the answer is yes, we move accordingly. If no, the employee is off the hook and it's business as usual. Alfred's very expensive." "I was afraid so. How much?" "Well, he has 16 years with the Bureau and is a career man. That's why he's so cautious. He has much to lose." "How much?" $500,000. "Damn. Of course, we have to make a small profit on the transaction. After all, Alfred is ours." "A small profit?" "Quite small, really. Most of it goes to Alfred. He talks to Voyles daily, you know. His office is two doors down." "All right, we'll pay." Tubertini flashed a conquering smile and tasted his wine. "I think you lied, Mr. Lazarov. You said it was a small unit in Memphis. That's not true, is it?"
"No."
"What's the name of this unit?"
"The Bendini firm."
old man Morolto's daughter married a Bandini.
That's it.
What's the employee's name?
Mitchell McDear.
It might take 2 or 3 weeks. Meeting with Alfred is a major production.
Yes. Just be quick about it.
Chapter 27. It was highly unusual for wives to appear at the quiet little fortress on Front Street. They were certainly welcome, they were told, but seldom invited. So Abby McDear arrived through the front door into the reception area, uninvited and unannounced. It was imperative that she see her husband, she insisted. The receptionist phoned Nina on the second floor, and within seconds she appeared in a rush and warmly greeted her boss's wife. Mitch was in a meeting, she explained.
He's always in a damned meeting, Abby replied. Get him out!
They rushed to his office, where Abby closed the door and waited. Mitch was observing another one of Avery's chaotic departures. Secretaries bumped into each other and packed briefcases while Avery yelled into the phone. Mitch sat on the sofa with a legal pad and watched. His partner was scheduled for 2 days on Grand Cayman. April 15th loomed on the calendar like a date with a firing squad, and the banks down there had certain records that had become critical. It was all work, Avery insisted. He talked about the trip for 5 days, dreading it, cursing it, but finding it completely unavoidable. He would take the Lear, and it was now waiting, said a secretary. Probably waiting with a load of cash, thought Mitch. Avery slammed the phone down and grabbed his coat. Nina walked through the door and glared at Mitch. Mr. McDear, your wife is here. She says it's an emergency. The chaos became silent. He looked blankly at Avery. The secretaries froze. What is it? He asked, standing. She's in your office, Nina said.
Mitch, I've got to go, Avery said. I'll call you tomorrow. I hope things are okay.
Sure. He followed Nina down the hall, saying nothing, to his office. Abby sat on his desk. He closed and locked the door. He watched her carefully.
Mitch, I have to go home.
Why? What's happened?
My father just called at school. They found a tumor in one of Mother's lungs. They're operating tomorrow.
He breathed deeply. I'm so sorry. He did not touch her. She was not crying.
I must go. I've taken a leave of absence at school.
For how long?
It was a nervous question.
She looked past him to the ego wall.
I don't know, Mitch. We need some time apart. I'm tired of a lot of things right now, and I need time. I think it will be good for both of us.
Let's talk about it.
You're too busy to talk, Mitch. I've been trying to talk for 6 months, but you can't hear me.
How long will you be gone, Abby?
I don't know. I guess it depends on Mother.
No, it depends on a lot of things.
You're scaring me, Abby.
I'll be back. I promise. I don't know when.
Maybe a week. Maybe a month.
I need to sort out some things.
A month?
I don't know, Mitch. I just need some time, and I need to be with Mother.
I hope she's okay. I mean that.
I know. I'm going home to pack a few things, and I'll leave in an hour or so.
All right.
Be careful. I love you, Mitch.
He nodded and watched as she opened the door. There was no embrace.
On the fifth floor, a technician rewound the tape and pushed the emergency button direct to Devasher's office. He appeared instantly and slapped the headphones over his extra-large cranium. He listened for a moment. "Rewind," he demanded. He was quiet for another moment. "When did this happen?" he asked. The technician looked at a panel of digital numbers. 2:14 ago. In his office, second floor.
Damn. She's leaving him, ain't she?
No talk of separation or divorce before this.
No, you would have known about it.
They've argued about his workaholic routine, and he hates her parents, but nothing like this.
Yeah. Check with Marcus, and see if he's heard anything before. Check the tapes in case we've missed something. Damn.
Abby started for Kentucky, but did not make it. An hour west of Nashville, she left Interstate 40 and turned north on Highway 13. She had noticed nothing behind her. She drove 80 at times, then 50. Nothing. At the small town of Clarksville, near the Kentucky line, she abruptly turned east on Highway 12. An hour later, she entered Nashville through a county highway, and the red Peugeot was lost in city traffic. She parked it in the long-term section at Nashville Airport and caught a shuttle to the terminal. In a restroom on the first floor, she changed into khaki walking shorts, bass loafers, and a navy knit pullover. It was a cool outfit, a little out of season, but she was headed for warmer weather. She pulled her shoulder-length hair into a ponytail and forced it under her collar. She changed sunglasses and stuffed the dress, heels, and pantyhose into a canvas gym bag. Almost 5 hours after she left Memphis, she walked to the Delta boarding gate and presented her ticket. She asked for a window seat. No Delta flight in the free world can bypass Atlanta, but fortunately she was not forced to change planes. She waited by her window and watched darkness fall on the busy airport. She was nervous, but tried not to think about it. She drank a glass of wine and read a Newsweek. 2 hours later, she landed in Miami and left the plane. She walked rapidly through the airport, catching stares but ignoring them. They're just the usual everyday stares of admiration and lust, she told herself. Nothing more. At the one and only Cayman Airways boarding gate, she produced her round-trip ticket and the required birth certificate and driver's license. Wonderful people, these Caymanians, but they won't allow you in their country unless you've already purchased a ticket to get out. Please come and spend your money, then leave. Please. She sat in a corner of the crowded room and tried to read. A young father with a pretty wife and two babies kept staring at her legs, but no one else noticed her. The flight to Grand Cayman would leave in 30 minutes. After a rough start, Avery gained momentum and spent 7 hours at the Royal Bank of Montreal, Georgetown, Grand Cayman branch. When he left at 5 p.m., the complimentary conference room was filled with computer printouts and account summaries. He would finish tomorrow. He needed McDear, but circumstances had worked to seriously curtail his travel plans. Avery was now exhausted and thirsty, and things were hot on the beach. At Rumheads, he picked up a beer at the bar and worked his well-tanned body through the crowd to the patio, where he looked for a table. As he strode confidently past the domino game, Tammy Greenwood Hempfill of Greenwood Services nervously but nonchalantly entered the crowd and sat on a stool at the bar. She watched him. Her tan was store-bought, machine-inflicted, with some areas browner than others. But on the whole, it was an enviable tan for late March. The hair was now colored, not bleached, to a soft, sandy blonde, and the makeup, likewise, had been tempered. The bikini was state-of-the-art, bright, fluorescent orange that demanded attention. The large breasts hung wonderfully and stretched the strings and patches to their limit.
The small patch across the rear was woefully incapable of covering anything. She was 40, but 20 sets of hungry eyes followed her to the bar, where she ordered a club soda and fired up a cigarette. She smoked it and watched him. He was a wolf. He looked good, and he knew it. He sipped his beer and slowly examined every female within 50 yards. He locked into one, a young blonde, and seemed ready to pounce when her man arrived and she sat in his lap. He sipped his beer and continued to survey. Tammy ordered another club soda with a twist of lime and started for the patio. The wolf locked into the big breasts immediately and watched them bounce his way. "Mind if I sit down?" she asked. He half stood and reached for the chair. "Please do." It was a great moment for him. Of all the hungry wolves lusting around the bar and patio at Rumhead's, she picked him. He had had younger babes, but at this moment, at this place, she was the hottest. "I'm Avery Tolar, from Memphis." "Nice to meet you. I'm Libby. Libby Locks from Birmingham." Now, she was Libby. She had a sister named Libby, a mother named Doris, and her name was Tammy. And she hoped to hell she could keep it all straight. Although she wore no rings, she had a husband whose legal name was Elvis, and he was supposed to be in Oklahoma City impersonating the king, and probably screwing teenage girls with Love Me Tender t-shirts. "What brings you here?" Avery asked. "Just fun. Got in this morning. Staying at the Palms. You?" "I'm a tax lawyer, and believe it or not, I'm here on business. I'm forced to come down several times a year. Real torture."
"Where are you staying?"
He pointed. "My firm owns those two condos over there. It's a nice little write-off."
"Very pretty."
The wolf did not hesitate. "Would you like to see them?" She giggled like a sophomore.
"Maybe later."
He smiled at her. This would be easy. He loved the islands. "What are you drinking?" he asked.
"Gin and tonic. Twist of lime."
He left for the bar and returned with the drinks. He moved his chair closer to her. Now their legs were touching. The breasts were resting comfortably on the table. He looked down between them. "Are you alone?" Obvious question, but he had to ask it.
"Yeah. You?"
"Yeah. Do you have any plans for dinner?"
"Not really."
"Good. There's this great cookout there at the Palms beginning at 6. The best seafood on the island. Good music. Rum punch. The works. No dress code."
"I'm game."
They moved closer together and his hand was suddenly between her knees. His elbow nestled next to her left breast, and he smiled. She smiled. This was not altogether unpleasant, she thought, but there was business at hand. The Barefoot Boys began to tune up, and the festival began. Beachcombers from all directions flocked to the Palms. Natives in white jackets and white shorts lined up folding tables and laid heavy cotton cloths over them. The smell of boiled shrimp and grilled amberjack and barbecued shark filled the beach. The lovebirds, Avery and Libby, walked hand in hand into the courtyard of the Palms and lined up for the buffet. For 3 hours they dined and danced, drank and danced, and fell madly in heat over each other. Once he became drunk, she returned to straight club soda. Business was at hand. By 10, he was sloppy, and she led him away from the dance floor to the condo next door. He attacked her at the front door, and they kissed and groped for 5 minutes. He managed the key, and they were inside.
One more drink, she said, ever the party girl. He went to the bar and fixed her a gin and tonic. He was drinking scotch and water.
They sat on the balcony outside the master bedroom and watched a half moon decorate the gentle sea. She had matched him drink for drink, he thought, and if she could handle another, then so could he. But nature was calling again, and he excused himself. The scotch and water sat on the wicker table between them, and she smiled at it. Much easier than she had prayed for. She took a small plastic packet from the orange strap between her legs and dumped one capsule of chloral hydrate into his drink. She sipped her gin and tonic.
"Drink it up, big boy," she said when he returned. "I'm ready for bed."
He grabbed his whiskey and gulped it down. The taste buds had been numb for hours. He took another swallow, then began to relax. Another swallow. His head wobbled from shoulder to shoulder, and finally his chin hit his chest. The breathing became heavy. "Sleep well, lover boy," she said to herself. With a man of 180 pounds, one shot of chloral hydrate would induce a dead sleep for 10 hours. She took his glass and gauged what was left. Not much. 8 hours, to be safe. She rolled him out of the chair and dragged him to the bed. Head first, then feet. Very gently she pulled his yellow and blue surfer shorts down his legs and laid them on the floor. She stared for a long second, then tucked the sheets and blankets around him. She kissed him goodnight. On the dresser she found 2 key rings, 11 keys. Downstairs in the hall between the kitchen and the great room with a view of the beach, she found the mysterious locked door Mitch had found in November. He had paced off every room, upstairs and down, and determined this room to be at least 15 by 15. It was suspicious because the door was metal, and because it was locked, and because a small storage sign was affixed to it. It was the only labeled room in the condo. A week earlier in Unit B, he and Abby had found no such room. 1 key ring held a key to a Mercedes, 2 keys to the Bendini building, a house key, 2 apartment keys, and a desk key. The keys on the other ring were unmarked and fairly generic. She tried it first, and the 4th key fit. She held her breath and opened the door. No electric shocks, no alarms, nothing. Mitch told her to open the door, wait 5 minutes, and if nothing happened, then turn on the light. She waited 10 minutes. 10 long and frightful minutes. Mitch had speculated that Unit A was used by the partners and trusted guests, and that Unit B was used by the associates and others who required constant surveillance. Thus, he hoped, Unit A would not be laden with wires and cameras and recorders and alarms. After 10 minutes, she opened the door wide and turned on the light. She waited again and heard nothing. The room was square, about 15 by 15, with white walls, no carpet, and, as she counted, 12 fireproof legal-size file cabinets. Slowly she walked over to one and pulled the top drawer. It was unlocked. She turned off the light, closed the door, and returned to the bedroom upstairs, where Avery was now comatose and snoring loudly. It was 10:30. She would work like crazy for 8 hours and quit at 6 in the morning. Near a desk in a corner, 3 large briefcases sat neatly in a row. She grabbed them, turned off the lights, and left through the front door. The small parking lot was dark and empty, with a gravel drive leading to the highway. A sidewalk ran next to the shrubbery in front of both units and stopped at a white board fence along the property line. A gate led to a slight grassy knoll, with the first building of the Palms just over it. It was a short walk from the condos to the Palms,
but the briefcases had grown much heavier when she reached room 188. It was on the first floor, front side, with a view of the pool but not of the beach. She was panting and sweating when she knocked on the door. Abby yanked it open. She took the briefcases and placed them on the bed. Any problems?
Not yet. I think he's dead.
Tammy wiped her face with a towel and opened a can of Coke.
Where is he?
Abby was all business, no smiles. In his bed. I figure we've got 8 hours, until 6. Did you get in the room? Abby asked as she handed her a pair of shorts and a bulky cotton shirt.
Yeah, there's a dozen big file cabinets unlocked, a few cardboard boxes and other junk, but not much else.
A dozen?
Yeah, tall ones, all legal size. We'll be lucky to finish by 6.
It was a single motel room with a queen-size bed. The sofa, coffee table, and bed were pushed to the wall, and a Canon Model 8580 copier with automatic feed and collator sat in the center with engines running. On lease from Island Office Supply, it came at the scalper's price of $300 for 24 hours, delivered. It was the newest and largest rental copier on the island, the salesman had explained, and he was not excited about parting with it for only a day. But Abby charmed him and began laying $100 bills on the counter. 2 cases of copy paper, 10,000 sheets, sat next to the bed. They opened the first briefcase and removed 6 thin files.
Same type of files, Tammy mumbled to herself.
She unhitched the 2-prong clasp on the inside of the file and removed the papers.
Mitch says they're very particular about their files, Tammy explained as she unstapled a 10-page document.
He says lawyers have a 6th sense and can almost smell if a secretary or a clerk has been in a file. So you'll have to be careful. Work slowly. Copy 1 document, and when you restaple it, try to line up with the old staple holes.
It's tedious.
Copy only 1 document at a time, regardless of the number of pages. Then put it back together slowly and in order. Then staple your copy so everything stays in order. With the automatic feed, the 10-page document took 8 seconds.
Pretty fast, Tammy said.
The first briefcase was finished in 20 minutes. Tammy handed the 2 key rings to Abby and picked up 2 new, empty, all-canvas Samsonite handbags. She left for the condo. Abby followed her out the door, then locked it. She walked to the front of the Palms, to Tammy's rented Nissan Stanza. Dodging at oncoming traffic from the wrong side of the road, she drove along 7 Mile Beach and into Georgetown. 2 blocks behind the stately Swiss Bank building, on a narrow street lined with neat frame houses, she found the one owned by the only locksmith on the island of Grand Cayman. At least, he was the only one she'd been able to locate without assistance. He owned a green house with open windows and white trim around the shutters and the doors. She parked in the street and walked through the sand to the tiny front porch, where the locksmith and his neighbors were drinking and listening to Radio Cayman. Solid gold reggae. They quietened when she approached, and none of them stood. It was almost 11. He had said that he would do the job in his shop out back, and that his fees were modest, and that he would like a 1/5 of Meyer's rum as a down payment before he started.
Mr. Dantley, I'm sorry I'm late. I've brought you a little gift.
She held out the 1/5 of rum. Mr. Dantley emerged from the darkness and took the rum. He inspected the bottle.
Boys, a bottle of Meyer's.
Abby could not understand the chatter, but it was obvious the gang on the porch was terribly excited about the bottle of Meyer's. Dantley handed it to them and led Abby behind his house to a small outbuilding full of tools and small machines and 100 gadgets. A single yellow light bulb hung from the ceiling and attracted mosquitoes by the hundreds. She handed Dantley the 11 keys, and he carefully laid them on a bare section of a cluttered workbench. "This will be easy," he said, without looking up. Although he was drinking at 11 at night, Dantley appeared to be in control. Perhaps his system had built an immunity to rum. He worked through a pair of thick goggles, drilling and carving each replica. After 20 minutes, he was finished. He handed Abby the two original sets of keys and their copies. "Thank you, Mr. Dantley. How much do I owe you?" "They were quite easy," he drawled. $1 per key." She paid him quickly and left. Tammy filled the two small suitcases with the contents of the top drawer of the first file cabinet. 5 drawers, 12 cabinets, 60 trips to the copier and back. In 8 hours. It could be done. There were files, notebooks, computer printouts, and more files. Mitch said to copy it all. He was not exactly sure what he was looking for, so copy it all. She turned off the light and ran upstairs to check on Loverboy. He had not moved. The snoring was in slow motion. The Samsonites weighed 30 pounds apiece, and her arms ached when she reached room 188. First trip out of 60. She would not make it. Abby had not returned from Georgetown, so Tammy unloaded the suitcases neatly on the bed. She took one drink from her Coke and left with the empty bags. Back to the condo. Drawer 2 was identical. She fitted the files in order into the suitcases and strong-armed zippers. She was sweating and gasping for breath. 4 packs a day, she thought. She vowed to cut back to 2. Maybe even 1 pack. Up the stairs to check on him. He had not breathed since her last trip. The copier was clicking and humming when she returned from trip 2. Abby was finishing the 2nd briefcase, about to start on the 3rd. "Did you get the keys?" Tammy asked. "Yeah, no problem." "What's your man doing?" "If the copier wasn't running, you could hear him snoring." Tammy unpacked into another neat stack on the bed. She wiped her face with a wet towel and left for the condo. Abby finished the 3rd briefcase and started on the stacks from the file cabinets. She quickly got the hang of the automatic feed, and after 30 minutes she moved with the efficient grace of a seasoned copy room clerk. She fed copies and unstapled and restapled while the machine clicked rapidly and spat the reproductions through the collator. Tammy arrived from trip 3 out of breath and with sweat dripping from her nose. 3rd drawer, she reported. "He's still snoring." She unzipped the suitcases and made another neat pile on the bed. She caught her breath, wiped her face, and loaded the now copied contents of drawer 1 into the bags. For the rest of the night, she would be loaded, coming and going. At midnight, the Barefoot Boys sang their last song, and the Palms settled down for the night. The quiet hum of the copier could not be heard outside room 188. The door was kept locked, the shades pulled tightly, and all lights extinguished except for a lamp near the bed. No one noticed the tired lady, dripping with sweat, lugging the same 2 suitcases to and from the room. After midnight, they did not speak. They were tired, too busy and scared, and there was nothing to report except Loverboy's movements in bed, if any. And there were none, until around 1 a.m., when he subconsciously rolled onto his side, where he stayed for about 20 minutes, then returned to his back. Tammy checked on him with each visit and asked herself each time what she would do if his eyes suddenly opened and he attacked. She had a small tube of mace in her shorts pocket, just in case a confrontation occurred and escape became necessary. Mitch had been vague on the details of such an escape. "Just don't lead him back to the motel room," he said. "Hit him with the mace, then run like crazy and scream rape." But after 25 trips, she became convinced he was hours away from consciousness. And it was bad enough hiking like a pack mule to and from, but she also had to climb the stairs, 14 of them, each trip to check on Casanova. So she went to check every other trip. Then one out of three. By 2 a.m., halfway through the project,